Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks,
a holly jolly podcast.
What antiques are we talking about this week?
I wanted to talk about something that's close to my heart because I hate it so goddamn much.
Yay!
We're going to talk about knee-hugger elves and every horrible thing they've done to humanity since they began to exist.
Huzzah!
So, do you know what a knee-hugger elf is?
I have a grim image in my mind of a little mid-century modern sneaky elf face with like a smile that's too wide and the eyes are shifted over to one side and it's got like long Betty Spaghetti wire arms and legs and it's just curled up on itself peering at me.
A phenomenally accurate picture of the knee-hugging elf.
I've done it. I've won antiques.
If that sounded familiar to you, we'll get to that. But, so yeah, the knee-hugger elves are these little elves. They usually have injection-molded hollow plastic heads.
Hate it.
Yeah. Sometimes they've got needle-sculpted felt heads, like the Anna Lee dolls, which, like, spoiler alert, is how I got here.
Oh.
And that'll be its own episode eventually, because those things are mystifying to me. But usually injection-molded plastic heads, and they have little wire bodies that are wrapped in felt or burlap, traditionally. And you might notice that those are very cheap fabrics. And they have wire limbs that are not bound, so they do sometimes poke out, that bend so that you can pose the elf or perch it in any way, shape, or form you like. They were called knee huggers because originally they were packaged with their big, long, horrible spider legs bent up to their chests with their arms wrapped around them. And that was just so they'd fit in a packaging box.
Makes them much more compact.
And then people just left them like that so much that they started manufacturing versions that could never leave that position.
Oh, that's horrifying.
I swear to God, I don't hate Christmas, but it's going to come out like that. But so to get into the history of these jolly, horrible little leering pixies, we have to go back to what I call the golden seed of Christmas, World War II.
What?
A classic in any Christmas lover's history of Christmas. So they were manufactured in post-war Japan around the late 1940s, 1950s. Notably, you can actually trace the knee huggers back to a company called Yuletide, although now nothing remains of this company, even informationally aside from the packaging that they came in. And Yuletide sold a little miniature Christmas tree that had three little pixies, they were called pixies, in little metallic suits with bells on their little tiny ankles, and you would pose them in the Christmas tree. So it was like a little Christmas toy kind of thing. So this is, like, actually, as far as anyone can tell, the first instance of the Christmas pixies, which I like much better than the names that they would come to hold. And about why everyone forgot what Yuletide was, you might remember that in post-war Japan, it was American-occupied. All of the manufacturing businesses had been, let's call it, seized, because that's what happened, to manufacture products for American consumption, not just because it was a cheap way to manufacture American products, but it was a way for the Japanese economy to revitalize so they could repay their war debts to the Allies. As all good Christmas stories begin, eventually when they got popular, they would get licensed to a variety of other American-occupied Japanese companies, some of which we would remember, like Daikin, best known for extremely unpleasant, hard-faced Santa Clauses. I just had to mention that because I've seen so many of the Daikin Santas and they make me so uncomfortable. Ken's description of their faces was extremely accurate. They tended to have little turned up noses, big buggy blue eyes, pretty like traditional like 1950s cartoon schoolboy like sweepback haircut, and these big fat apple-y cheeks that were blushed and just horrifying little expressions. An expression that said, I know where it is. I know where it went. This was influenced really heavily by the success of the Holt Howard Pixies, which we have talked about if you're interested, and which I like better.
Check out our episode on Pixieware.
I'm blaming the mass production for the weird twisting of the facial features into something deeply unpleasant and grim.
Sure.
So, you know, Pixies and elf aesthetic, tchotchkes and kitsch stuff was already taking off in the 1950s. So it was kind of natural, especially since elves had already been introduced to the commercial Christmas canon by a variety of advertisements and Norman Rockwell. So it kind of made sense that they would take the popular image of the, like, retro kitsch pixie and turn it into Christmas. I was interested to find that a lot of the influence on that, like, whole look was also from, like, the whole Japanese cultural exchange and their interest in, like, Disney cuteness.
Oh, yeah.
Bambi was made in 1943. It was extremely influential on, like, several Japanese artists, and, well, it turned into anime, so we all know where that went, but I think that's interesting. It's a cool mashup of American and Japanese, like, cultural aesthetics.
Yeah.
The heads were... Here's the reason I wanted to do this episode at all. The heads were frequently made with celluloid.
Oh.
Now, what do you know about celluloid?
Oh, that it catches fire when you look at it wrong.
I found 10 newspaper accounts from the 1950s of exactly that happening.
Of spontaneous elf combustion?
Spontaneous. I want you to picture its leering, horrible little eyes, and you're staring at it, and it's close to, like, maybe a little bubble light, and then it just bursts into flames.
'Tis the season.
So yeah, be careful buying vintage knee-hugger elves, because they can and will explode.
Oopsies.
And they're full of sharp wires. They're generally really bad toys.
Yeah, they're not great for children.
Not unlike carnival wear. These nasty little spider-legged elves popped up in, like, literally every kind of product you can imagine.
Oh, I bet.
They would just tie them, like a St. Andrew's cross, to boxes of candy.
Oh, no.
They would be in, like, boxes of hot cereal because I forgot the word for oatmeal just now.
Technically also called hot cereal. You're not wrong.
I got it right, but I was so stunned that I forgot the word. But yeah, they shoved these little motherfuckers into pretty much everything they'd fit into as like a marketing thing, which I think is why everyone seems to have some sort of, well, okay, let me amend that. Everyone over the age of 30 seems to have some sort of warm memory of these things, and even then I'm skewing pretty low.
Yeah, I feel like the people who were children in the 50s have very warm memories of these things, and everybody after that is like, why the fuck is this in your house on purpose?
Ken, that's an amazing segue, because we're going to talk about why the fuck they're in our house on purpose. In 2004...
Oh god, why? No.
You know where this was always going to end.
Is it Beanie Babies?
Yeah. No, actually. Although, I predict it's going to very much go the way of Beanie Babies.
Oh, good. Good. I can't wait.
In 2004, a writer by the name of Carol Abersold, and I'm being generous with the word writer, published a book called The Elf on the Shelf.
Generous with the word writer, indeed.
It was a book about scout elves that would hide in your home and watch your children for bad or good behavior, and then fly like little rocket men back to the North Pole every night to report to Santa on a daily basis, and then go back to your home and hide again to watch you.
Absolutely horrifying.
Carol Abersold claimed that this was based on a quirky, funny family tradition that had been born of their decoration of knee-hugger elves as a child. I think this is actually pretty likely.
That her parents hated her enough to tell her this?
From her retelling, I read an interview, and in her retelling, their version of the tradition was gentler, where it was just that, like, the elves were capable of communicating with Santa, and if they saw you do something particularly bad, they would tell him. How it evolved is... I don't know why you would go that far with it.
Yeah.
Because Carol Abersold introduced the new versions, which is that, frankly, every parent in America had to suffer because you had to every night, you know, put the elf somewhere new for the kids to find, like, where's Waldo? Which I assume is the part that the kids enjoy.
Until they start having nightmares about the elf watching them and come to you crying in the middle of the night because they can't escape it.
True, and they might not know where it is that day.
Which does keep happening.
It's a pretty consistent result. One thing I found really, really funny about The Elf on the Shelf, the official book, is that no one published it. In fact, so many people turned down the book that she just created her own publishing company.
Did no one tell her about Ingram Spark?
Well, Ken, do you want to tell us about Ingram Spark?
Why, did she use Ingram Spark?
No, I mean, could you tell? I haven't heard about Ingram Spark.
Yeah, it's a independent self-publishing company where you can make your books in either hard copies, like hardcover or paperback, or ebooks. And you can sell them not just through Amazon, but also through independent storefronts, such as bookshop.org.
Well, that probably would have been easier.
So I'm guessing she didn't use this service, which is, again, free of charge, except for, like, a percentage of royalties of book sales, which is negligible compared to what a publisher would take. And also, I'm assuming, negligible compared to the cost of starting a publishing company.
Yeah, you would imagine, right? From there, I don't really need to tell anybody, Elf of the Shelf kind of became a phenomena more than a book.
Yeah.
While looking, I found roughly 40 articles about what to do with your stupid little goddamned, like, Santa Claus security camera. And plenty of people just really upset that they would go to bed and then remember that they had to hide the elf somewhere so that their children be appropriately terrified. And also, one of the rules is that you can't touch it or it loses its magic. If you touch the elf and it loses its Christmas magic to fly home, you've killed it. It can't live with you forever. It's dead.
It's awful on every level.
Apparently people got so tired of moving the goddamn thing around that they just decided that the elf had, like, undergone, like, a traumatic medical issue, and so it's had to stay put in the tree for a couple of days.
Yeah?
Yeah, I found a bunch of people who had made little tiny casts that you could put on your elf on the shelf so you could tell your kids that, like, he had COVID and he had to get on the Holly Jolly respirator for a couple of days. Like,
what?
It's grim and weird. And I don't know why a Christmas tradition should have to go that way.
What in the whole fuck?
Yeah, welcome to a completely normal way to talk to your children about Christmas. In general, what with the fact that this is, like, basically a new Christmas way of life for anyone with kids, there isn't a lot of information on these little fuckers.
Well, no. That would take away their mystery and their magic and their delight.
But there are millions of them. They were made for almost 15 years in Japan. So, part of what got me started on this whole, like, mess was definitely the fact that I'd always known about these things. They were just another one of the unpleasant vintage Christmas decorations that I did not think looked very good.
Uh-huh.
And then, without any kind of warning, people just started buying them. You know, we had big bins of them. They were just fucking everywhere. And then all of a sudden, we had none. And they were the hottest little thing that we had in the antique shop. And I didn't know why for, I would call, an embarrassingly long time. So the other thing is, now they're the vintage ones, like the actual, like, vintage antique ones, are getting kind of pricey.
Oh, good. The fire hazards are now desirable.
Yeah, everyone loves the fire hazards.
Great.
Listen to our episode on celluloid if you want to be able to identify which elf it will explode.
Spoiler alert, if it bursts into flame when it's warm, it was celluloid.
I'm picturing them getting celluloid sickness. Oh my god, that would be so horrible.
Oh yeah. There's no level on which these aren't horrifying.
I'm really sorry for anyone who likes these little guys.
I'm not.
Ken's not. This is a recurring theme on Antiques Freaks in regards to any kind of 50s kitsch.
Listen, I has my tastes. I keeps to it.
And hey, that's respectable. I was really enchanted, however, with these were being made by the actual millions. And like I said, they were a prize in every cereal box, every Christmas, so on and so forth. There are a lot of variations. And apparently these variations can net you some big goddamn money. Because back in the day, a really basic one of these little knee hugger, they're generally pretty small, they're palm-sized. They used to run like maybe $5 or $6 for like a regular kind of, this is a normal one. And now, for as like a standard actual vintage model, it is closer to $15 to $20 as a base price.
Damn.
So A, if you see these at a yard sale for cheap, like maybe a good investment.
How much for the ultra-rare not-on-fire variant?
That depends on a lot of factors. For example, does it have its original Made in Japan tag? Contemporaries almost never actually have these. They might be marked Made in China, which would be more likely. And I do mean, like, it's just a tag on the butt that says Made in Japan. Kind of like a classic for occupied Japan import markings. And, like Beanie Baby tags, they tend to come off. So if you got one on there, it's a good proof that this one's actually vintage. Obviously, thanks to Carol Abersold, we have lots and lots and lots of contemporary ones. But they're almost all identical, and the kind of plastic is really easy to spot. And their heads are full, which I don't like.
No. No full heads, please.
Yeah, so like a nice hollow face, you're gonna want to see wear on the face paint. You're gonna want to see some goofy, wonky face paint. Again, mass-produced. If you know that they're older and they have their little hats still, that was usually the first thing to go. And other than that, I think, from what I can tell, the biggest fun people have in collecting these is finding variants on the standard red and green. Some of them were absolutely goddamn spangled in bells, had, like, little Elizabethan lace collars, were coated in glitter. And some of them were just flat out not in Christmas colors. I saw one in purple and green.
Well, the thought counts.
Like, the idea was just that they were Christmas pixies. They weren't necessarily Santa's elves. They were just nasty little, like, creatures that hung around for Christmas. So you could make them look however you wanted. In fact, my favorite that I found on eBay for $70 was one that had the stereotypical knee-hugger elf face, but he also had little devil horns and a little spade tail.
Oh no! The evil is on the outside now.
A lot of them have mischievous expressions on purpose, because they were kind of holding more to the idea of elves as just being mischief creatures. And all of these, like, variations do make them more valuable. And like I said, with a base price of, like, 15 or 20 for something that you used to be able to get for, like, $3, if you got, like, a bucket of these bad boys in the basement, you could be turning over some cash. And all of the moms want them.
Oh, no. Or we could take the Beanie Baby approach and put them in big fires.
Or we could... Or, well, and it would be easy because you can start the fire with one of their kind.
Exactly. They're essentially kindling.
So, I mean, the issue with this is just that very, very few of them can be traced back to a company. So you kind of just have to go with your gut on what old plastic and felt would feel like. Generally, the more dangerous it feels, the better. Like, if it's got padding between the wires and the clothes, that is a bad sign. This is like the direct opposite of what is usually the case with reproductions, where we talk about reproductions being unpleasant or more like glass reproductions being cut sharp because you're not supposed to handle it. The opposite of that, where now they are given to children so they have to be made more safe.
If it feels as malicious as it is, it's genuine.
Probably. And there's tons of the little guys. Hundreds of them. Oh my god. You can also keep an eye out for the so-called original elves, the early Yuletide company elves. Was a set of three elves, like I said, in a miniature tree, and they were dressed in metallic red, metallic gold, and metallic silver, with bells and pom-poms all over them.
No.
In general, the metallic suited ones are pretty desirable. And that is a brief and unpleasant history of a new Christmas tradition that nobody likes.
Yay!
I have to talk about this. I have to talk about this. It'll kill me if I don't talk about this. Some of the most valuable ones I found were called Kamar knee-hugging elves. And Kamar was an American company that manufactured out of Japan. They actually were running for quite a long time. They did a bunch of official E.T. merchandise. And their knee-hugger elves had these upsetting little doll faces. We're talking, like, if you know what a Blythe doll looks like.
Sure.
Just, like, flat-out 1970s anime.
Oh, no.
Yeah. They are unpleasant to look at, and they still have the little wire noodle body. But just these, like, fully developed doll faces. And they run from, like, $50 to $200.
Damn.
Right? So, yeah, you can make money on these horrible little things. Go nuts at your next yard sale. And don't put any of them close to a warm light or they'll explode.
Or in direct sunlight.
Good luck. Sources today include theconversation.com, Undesigning Knee Hugger Elves, Class Multiculturalism and the Globalization of Christmas Kitsch. It's a hell of a title. Medium.com, Elf on the Shelf's Postwar Heritage, VintageGarageChicago.com, Vintage Elves on a Shelf, and CollectorsWeekly.com/Christmas/Elves.
If you would like to suggest an episode topic or just say hello, you can email AntiquesFreaksPodcast@gmail.com or check out our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends, or tag us on Tumblr, AntiquesFreaks.tumblr.com.
If you liked hearing us say elf and fuck in succession like that,
check out AO3, archiveofourown.org.
Yeah, go find some of my Lord of the Rings fanfictions. Or, when you're done with that, go back to your podcast device, scroll on down, and leave us a review thanking us for reminding you that there is Lord of the Rings, Yahweh. Or any other review you want. Any kind of review is a huge help to us. They make our hearts feel warm, and isn't that the greatest gift of all?
It is. If you would like to listen to deleted scenes or check out our live readings of The Gentleman's Art of Dressing with Economy with Drag King Guy Alias, Or if you would like to listen to our special podcast presentation of Varney the Vampire or the Feast of Blood, we are on chapter 13 now and it's getting crazy. You can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks. Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and filling our hearts with love.
So much love.
And thank you in particular for listening.
That's right, you.
Au revoir.
Goodbye.